Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Man, I'm feeling after. I'm feeling like we want to share all our creative insights of people trying to make it as independent artisans of some variety.
Mm-hmm. Justin Robert Young.
Yes, it's me, Justin Robert Young.
Gentlemen, you know, being a one of the things about being a creator, besides crying yourself to sleep a lot and the self-loathing, the feeling of inadequacy,
constant low-grade fear,
yeah,
low self-esteem.
You know that weird kind of like, it's kind of in the upper chest. It's kind of clenching, but it kind of cold. You know I'm talking about? That kind of weird kind of clench up there?
Yeah.
You know what? Actually, I got seized by a little of that today because I'm about to have the longest run of stuff on the road, the busiest travel that I've had maybe in the last year or two. And I don't know.
Brian's next 2 weeks are show in a live night attack in San Antonio tomorrow.
Yeah.
Come back, what, fly to New York?
Fly to New York.
For a private
Do a show, yeah. And then fly home for literally an hour, long enough to pick up a... I don't even know why I'm flying home.
Family, Brian. Family.
Well, I mean, I'm not even going to see them. And then I have to go to Miami.
Yeah.
And we're doing events in Miami,
yep,
and Tampa and Orlando
for the week.
Right. And then I go straight there up to Albany for my first ever performing arts gig where I'm doing two shows in one day. And it's been a hot minute since I've done the full stage
show. And these are theater shows.
Yeah, theater shows. That means everything has to be tip top.
Yeah.
I'm awake as you went through your schedule.
All right.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's, yeah, it's a lot of anxiety.
Anyway, I felt one of those kind of like, you know, panicky moments. And what helped today was making progress of any type on stuff that needed to be done. Like, it was so hard to start, but once I got started, it's like I felt everything relaxed. It's like no matter what else happens, I'm writing this letter, I'm booking this travel, I'm renting this car.
The expression work will set you free actually is kind of does feel true many times where like I get you just dive into a task and you're like, okay, I'm doing something, I'm paddling.
Yeah, so often the anxiety around conceptualizing conceptualizing what's going to happen is so much worse than actually just doing it, especially with people who are smart, I find.
So I've got a thing that I do now, and the problem is like one of my sources of anxiety is coming up with endless projects. I start this one, I'm like, well, should I keep this going? Should I drop this? Whatever. I am a serial project starter. The biggest change in my life happened when I learned how to finish things too. It was great to start things. Learning how to finish things was even better. And the problem was is then, you know, I learned like, wow, I can write books, I can do this, but now I have to choose things. And the problem is often we don't know until we get in the middle of it where we need to go, how much effort we want to do. We talk about sunk cost fallacy, but there's the problem of that versus when you shouldn't give up and you can use whatever excuse you do. And I have a new tool that I use.
Oh.
I've talked about it briefly. And it has helped me considerably.
What is that?
And it is there's a science fiction writer who created this religion. And I'm talking about Robert Heinlein, actually. No, what I do is, I've mentioned this before, but it really has become a thing that I do. It's mission statements, whether it's a book, whether it's a project or it's something, not in a public facing, this is what I tell the world I'm going to do, in a, this is why I'm going to do it. It started with books because I wanted to make sure that I didn't get lost on the way in trying to finish a book, because I found out that now that I know how to write and I can write fast, I can turn around a book very, very quickly, but I could turn around a book and be, you know what? I missed the mark. I didn't do this with the character. I didn't do that where I wanted to go. And I made a decision about a month or so that every time I started on a project, I had to write down a mission statement and say, this book is going to be about this character. And this is it's not quite an outline. It's really, this is the, I want to have a character arc. I want to have these things. It's not so much a specific beat by bit of what happens. It's sort of the goal of the thing. So if I get adrift, I know where to go. I turned in kind of my first book since I did this, and it was a book that I wrote in 10 days, and I got a great response from my agent, my editor, and all that. I'm like, okay, this helped me stay focused on this, and now I applied to other things. So,
yeah, so we over at Scam Stuff, we, you know, put out these mystery jackpot boxes, and they were much more popular than we had expected, and so we found ourselves with a very, very big task. And as we have a new guy on our team who's really kind of just spearheading everything, and I can't hold his hand, I can't walk him through everything. So instead, you know, I'm trying to teach him broader lessons. And one of the things that we talked about today was because he's assembling some of the boxes and working through it, and he had started putting stuff together. And we talked about, like, well, how many do you have? He's like, it's a lot. I'm like, that's not a number. You know, it's like, you know, give me the exact amount. He's like, okay. Well, like, and it's like, do you have enough ingredients for all of them? He's like, almost. And like, that's not a percentage. And it's like, you begin with the ending in mind, because if you should not pack even one box until you know why you're packing and what the goal is, how to accomplish it, you know, and all that stuff. And so we sat down and we did a mission statement where it's like, our goal is, number one, to make everybody happy. That is the most important thing. Second of all, it's to accomplish, you know, making use of these items that are valuable and awesome, but aren't currently in rotation that will be appreciated in this context. And also, if we can do it, you know, make a few bucks. And having that as a guiding, you know, actually writing that in advance made it to where he was empowered to make decisions without asking me on everything.
Mm. Well, and so often by not making the early decision, you supercharge how big of a problem small decisions can be along the way. So like what you did in practicality means, okay, number one priority is making everybody happy, which means if this is a thinner margin than we normally sell it at, that's fine.
Right.
Like now we don't
Or even at a loss in some
Or
cases.
Even at a loss, yeah. Right? So it's like now you just have that guiding idea that it's like, okay, well, this is all right. It's all right to do this, as opposed to getting to a point where you're like, I don't know. Is this margin where we needed to be? It's like, just pull the Band-Aid off, right? And having that that there. And to Andrew's point, you know, for like a book, being able to say, hey, look, this is what this book is about. And from this like vantage point, this book needs to be about this. If in the process that changes, like, or I find myself drifting to do something radically different, then you want to know what? That can be the next one. But this one needs to get done.
It's something I've been applying to other tasks, because I find out it is, as you guys addressed, is that, you know, like getting those mystery boxes out the door, it could be, well, it comes down to getting it out the door. It's like, nope, number one is delight. And if we're just trying to get these things out the door, then we failed at this most important critical step, and we're not doing the thing that we set out to do. And I with my writing, like, well, I could just finish it. I'm like, no. And sometimes I've stopped projects in the middle when I had like great momentum. Like, yeah, I'm racing towards the finish line, but I'm not doing what I need to be doing, and I need to go back to what the core is. So I would say that, and these things are hundreds of years old, the idea of a mission statement, how they apply to businesses and everything. But I would say that it's certainly something to think about applying. And, you know, in school and stuff, they ask you to do these things, but I think they're kind of provided without a context. You don't understand why you're doing this, or you're just told it's a part. You know, if we're the kind of kids who would write the report and then write the outline afterwards to show that we did it.
Right.
And I encounter adults who are like, yeah, I'm like that kind. I write it afterwards. And I'm like, yeah, I was like that too. And then when I became that guy, when I had that capability, and then I added that, the ability to write the outline in the beginning and then go do it, guess what? My work got a lot better.
Well, because it's easier, you know, and that's what you, you know, I think people who are good in the moment can tend to let those habits dominate, you know, and I'm certainly very guilty of that, because it's like, whatever, like, I'll improvise along the way. It's where my best ideas come from, like, LOL. Yeah. But really, you're overloading that. You're not giving those creative instincts kind of the time to really work. Because if you're on a path, there's plenty of opportunities where you need to think creatively. There's plenty of opportunities for you to think out of the box. The concept does not necessarily need to be freeform.
You know, that whole, it's like, where are my best ideas? And I've said these things, but then as I've gotten older and more analytical, I'm like, yeah, well, why is it? Because the idea fairy decided to go visit me at that point.
Yeah.
It's no, because all of a sudden, because of other reasons, my attention was focused. So it wasn't really the fact that I waited the last minute that magic happened. It's what's because when I was really focused on it, magic happened. And maybe if I learn how focus works.
Well, and think of it as, because I've been thinking about goal setting and like, why is it that when you program yourself to get a certain thing done, that's when you have the epiphany? Because, you know, it's like, it feels like magic when you write the goal and it comes true. But basically all you're doing is you're consciously deciding the lens through which you look at the random mishmash of stuff. You're thinking about why does the moon sit there when you see the apple fall or whatever. And it's not that, you know, you see apples fall all the time, but it's through the lens of that question. And of course, that's all apocryphal. It didn't happen, but whatever. But I mean, it's a good example.
No apple has ever fallen, guys.
Yeah, correct. And there is no moon. It's a space station. But anyway, it just seems like much having a mission statement gives a clarifying element to every decision you make from that point forward. If you're adding a robot into your novel, you're like, well, is this congruous with my mission statement of, you know, making people feel something very human? It's like, well, maybe if it's about a robot who wants to become a boy or whatever.
If you have like a business project, like when I set out to do like a web project or whatever, I have to say, it's going to be X, Y, and Z. It's going to have these things in it. And I find myself sometimes suffering from, you know, feature creep and adding things to it. And I'm like, no, I finished the thing I set out to do, and maybe I'm avoiding, you know, the next step. It's been helpful because it gives me permission when I'm in the middle of it to decide if I can walk away. I walk away if I'm like, oh, I failed the mission statement. You know, this did not satisfy it. You know, I say, okay, clearly this is not there. But if I'm like, no, this is hitting it. I'm just at this point where I'm stressed out and bored or whatever, like, well, I'm on target. My emotional – I have emotional reasons to leave, but not real ones. And, you know, the goal is to make it a – when you set out to do something, figure out concretely why you're doing this. Why are you trying to do this thing? If it's Brian, it's like, we got a bunch of inventory we need to clear out, and we have an opportunity to make people happy. Let's use those two things together. It is not primarily let's make some more cash. It's like, if you can make a profit, great. Clear inventory, make people happy, and if we satisfy those two things, then we are good. If we make a little profit, good, but the first two are critical. If you fail those two things.
By the way, that's been the fun part, is realizing that what I meant to be a small thing to clear out certain parts of overstock in a fun way that would delight people, suddenly I realized, oh, crap. I've done a Kickstarter, and I just crowdfunded a thing because a lot of people gave me money, and all I did was give them the promise that they would be surprised and happy with whatever I sent them. And so now I'm dealing with the issues that
– It's going to be cocaine, right?
Now I'm dealing with the issues that come with that of course, Justin's all too familiar with, where I realize like, okay, there's no way to get them everything instantly because while it's here, what I'm promising is an individualized experience and all that stuff. And so now what I have to do is – you know, I am also selling a story, which means I am writing, you know, emails every other day saying, you know, here's where we're at. Here's what's happening. Like today, I just sent an email saying, hey, we're literally packing your thing. Super important survey. It's got one question. And it just went there and you're like, what's your order number? Hey, do you mind if we send you something alcohol related? Like, and that's it. And they're like, peace out. but it lets them know this is not a fantasy. I'm not selling fairy dust. I'm not going to take their money, leave them looking like a sucker, like Justin was saying is the number one concern.
Well, that's the big fear with any kind of Kickstarter thing or something like that you're doing now, which is that nobody wants to be made a fool out of, you know, because it sucks when you buy something that you know what you're getting and it turns out to be less than what you expect. It double sucks when you actually believe in something or you are trusting somebody, especially somebody with scam in their store's title. And you know, you hope that this isn't an LOL. You know, like, oh, you get a bag of fleas. Ha ha. Well, another classic jape from Brian Brushwood.
You gotta let me write this down.
What's the fleas cost?
I know. Yeah. Is that legal to send in the mail? But yeah, you know, it's a real interesting thing. But I mean, what Andrew got to is really important, because right now that's the situation that we're at. We're writing a new card game, and right now we are at the point where it is not fun. Like, the fun part was the concept. The fun part was getting the initial puzzle pieces to work. It will be fun again once we start playtesting it in a more finished form, and we can see how people interact with it, and like that ball of clay can sort of start jumping and dancing to life, and you can be very proud of it. But right now, we're in the, like, polishing the edges in the dark phase, which is, like, very, 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 very unrewarding. You know?
You're that 3-day rock tumbler running where it's just like you just got to keep cranking that thing until everything's smooth.
It just sucks. And it sucks so much because you don't know. You could put a lot of work into something and all of a sudden find out that nobody likes that part or everybody finds it confusing. And now all of a sudden you got to just cut it, or you got to change it, or there's a lot of stuff that, like, in that process is just the not fun element of it. And you see that in comedy too. Comedy, especially if you're working on, like, a longer form thing.
Oof.
Like, now all of a sudden you're thinking about pauses and ways to interact with stuff. And you know from doing a stage show, like there's a point where a stage show is fun.
Yeah. Well, it's novel. Like, look at me, I did it. They're clapping.
And then you get to a point where it's like, well, this is about doing this a billion times and now playing the Guitar Hero video game of, like, well, that one didn't get as much of a applause line as it normally does. Is it because they suck or I suck? And let's now put it into my spreadsheet and my brain. Okay, well, let's say, well, they also didn't laugh at all these other stuff. Let's go ahead and say they suck. Let's, like, think about what we're going to do the next time we book this. I didn't do this, and they laughed at that, but they didn't laugh at this. Did I screw up? Did I do something? Should I tighten it? Like, it's a lot of unfun self-questioning.
Yeah. Well, and there are literal 70-minute shows that I began with, like, just, like this one line. I'm going to nail this one line. And I go through the whole show, and I get to that one part where I'm just, like, you know, because, like, the night before I had, like, an alternate take on it or whatever. So it's like you're doing a 70-minute performance for literally a 10-second moment, just and that's what you're focused on, so that
no,
you can smooth that rock.
No, the clean hand.
Yeah.
God, what a dick line that is.
Oh, yeah. No, that entire magician are awful. Like that entire dynamic. If I remember correctly, Seinfeld had the best line. Every magic trick is the same. Here's the quarter. Now it's gone. You're a jerk. Now it's back. You're still a jerk. Show's over.
Yeah. But yeah. But that's, to me, that's what separates people who get stuff done and people who don't. And also, it's the pratfall. The pitfall, rather. I guess you could also make it a pratfall, because it is comedic in how hilarious your destruction is. But, like, for a long time, I was seduced and had to work on myself from not just considering something done because I told people about it and they were like, great! And I'm like, awesome! Well, that's pretty much all I wanted out of this whole project was people to like it. So, and people to call me really smart, kind of don't have to do it now, you know, because, you know, beyond that, there's a valley.
Yeah.
And there's a greater glory on the other side. But who wants to walk through that valley when you could just get all the cheap heat?
You know, when I've been doing a lot of Periscope sessions, and I talk a lot about writing. And the thing, and I get questions like, well, how much money can you make with writing? I'm like, well, let's start. If that's your opening question, this is not for you.
Yeah.
And the thing I try to explain to people is that you go from, there's the part of you that's like, sure, I want to see this finished, complete thing, the big book. And, you know, like, that's all. And it is awesome to hold on to a finished, complete book. That is cool. By the way, I found out they're doing an audiobook for The Naturalist, too.
Oh, awesome.
So. And that's awesome. But the thing that I discovered was I have this, like, there was the, oh, I love to have the idea for the thing, and then I love to have the finished thing. But when I learned to enjoy the middle, the actual doing the work, it became a totally different experience. My reason for writing totally changed. And now it's, you know, it's, I write stuff that I never release. And I learned to like that. And the problem I got into is I liked that so much that I kind of like, man, I'll just sit down and write it. If it's great, it's great. If it's not, it's not. But I'm like, Yeah, but if I'm trying to hit a goal or make something specific happen, I better state what that is in advance and not just sort of hope that I hit it, which is, I think, a mistake a lot of writers make.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a hard road to hoe if you don't rewire your brain. But part of it is also just like, it is kind of a two-phase thing, because number one, you have to have the faith that you can do this thing, right? And get like in the process of doing it. And then once you believe in yourself, then you can rewire your brain to be better at doing it, you know? But it's complex, and you know, there's really, you know, I had somebody, he's been DMing me a bunch about like writing, like journalism writing, and you know, he's asked me a bunch of questions. I've been happy to answer them, and hit me up this week, and he's like, "Hey, don't sugarcoat it for me. Like, am I a crap writer? Like, I'm not here for a pat in the back. Like, am I a crap writer?" And I was like, "Well, you know, you're better than you were. You're not as good as you'll be in a year, and you're nowhere near as good as you'll be in 10 years. So, like, there is no secret sauce to, like, being, I mean, like, some of the people that I knew that were naturally kind of garbage as newspaper writers when I first started in college are the ones that are working in the profession today at the highest ranks, because they worked harder and better, and they got better and better and better. And like, there's just no, there's no easy way to do it, right? If you want to be great, it means doing it all, like you will be embarrassed by what you did initially. Fact.
There was a story that I heard, I've mentioned this before, but years ago, I took a comedy class on learning how to, you know, because I just wanted to, I had no interest in being a stand-up comedian, but I wanted to take stand-up comedy classes just to understand that part of entertainment. And the guys who put on this show, put on the class, they were actually bookers that booked other people. And they told a story about how they were booking shows, I think they're New York area. And they talked about they used to book shows, and they'd get this guy, this young comic, would call him up and say, "Hey, do you have any spots for me?" And they're like, "No, you're not funny. We don't like to use you because of that." He's like, he just wants to be the opener. The opener is like the lowest, you know, the lowest thing in there. It's the guy that starts off when people are just coming in and getting their drinks. It's like, "I'll drive your acts. I'll drive your comedy acts around. I'll pick him up from the condo, take him to the show, drive him back." And I'm like, "All right, but it's only $40. It's like, "I'll do it. I'll do it." And so they would pay him the $40. He'd go pick up the comics. He'd drive him to the show. He'd go do a stinky, it's just bad show. Then he'd sit through, watch the show. Then he'd get in the car. He'd drive the comics back, and he would ask him questions.
Yeah.
"How do I get better? What do I need to do? What am I doing wrong?" Kept doing it. It started off like he's 18, 19 years old, started doing this, kept doing it. And he kept calling him up, being really, he was a likable guy, but he's not a good comedian. He's just very, very persistent about that. But he kept, that was his thing. His part of the process was, if he drove, it wasn't just, "Hey, drive so I'll get the, you know, I'll get the gig." He was drive the acts so he could talk to them, have them trapped in a car, get advice from them, and start figuring out what he needed to do that. Eventually he gave up comedy, because he already was successful as Chris Rock and then could move on to other things. It was Chris Rock. And that was the story they talked about him. They said, "No, they're like, he was not funny. Like, you understand, like, he's not funny." They were in shock of the fact that now he's just really funny.
It's a mega comic, right?
Yeah, top comics of the world. And like, we know Chris when Chris was not good. Like, we know Chris was, but Chris would call us up, ask for these, you know, ask for this gig, beg, do this drive. But he was learning. That was their point, was he was learning how to get better. And they said he started off really, really, really bad, and he became great. Eddie Murphy was like a natural. And we talk about this where we get obsessed with people who are naturals, who are the prodigies. When we're teenagers, we want to be that. We want to have everything work out right for us. Then we find out that we really actually have to work. And if you really study prodigies, you don't want to be a prodigy. They have burnouts.
Oh, my gosh. No, yeah, that's the core, you know, that's the core start of every tragedy is the, you know, the guy who has it all, or the gifted person who everything's given to them. They don't appreciate it, and they make poor decisions. They overassume what they're capable of, and then they crater and crumble. And because they haven't built up the strength that comes from punching a rock 10,000 hours, you know, that they don't know how to deal with the failure. Yeah. And it really is like, not, it's so important you're going to be bad before you be good, which means, and we talked about this a million times, you need to have a safe space to be bad before you can be good. And, you know, scam school in the beginning, you go back there, they're not my best on-camera appearances. And BB Live Show, I would say, is not the tightest comedy performances Justin and I have ever done. But we kept showing up. And same thing with, man, it would be interesting to go back and listen to some of the very first episodes of Weird Things, because I feel like we have a much more natural flow to our conversation now compared to where we did back then.
Well, I've said this before. I've watched the evolution of you guys doing podcasting or stuff like this on almost a daily basis. And I look at myself and I go, you guys are years ahead of me. And we started all around the same time, but where at most I was doing one podcast a week, you guys are doing several, three, four, or five or whatever, and continuously doing that. I can see that. I listen and I can tell the difference between the guys who do it every day and this guy over here who does it once a week. Yeah. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit it. And it's proof that this thing works, the process of keep doing it.
Although that's what's so admirable. I mean, not that you're Gandhi or whatever, but like that's what I like seeing about you doing the Periscopes, right? Where it's like you found a new niche, a new opportunity to reach out to people. And you, I assume, because you're doing those, what, every day, every other day?
Every couple of days, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like you have now done 20 to 30 times the number of Periscopes I've done. And it's very difficult to keep up a one-sided conversation to a cell phone, you know? And how quickly are you seeing the transformation of how natural it feels and how quickly you build up your ability to cover for common, you know, let's say, connection hiccups or people asking questions or trolls or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm learning how to kind of like quickly get rid of somebody, spot who is really going to be a troll and who's just being a goofball, and just so it does it. I don't care, but it's like, oh, they're driving people nuts in the chat. How to do that? The biggest thing that I have is because it's just this sort of freeform thing. I get the same questions as other people come in there. Is how do I not make it feel too repetitious? Because like I'm like kind of like, if you've seen one Periscope session I've done, I kind of feel like you've probably seen them all. But I have new people come in all the time who really enjoy it because they never get a chance to talk to somebody who makes a living being creative in, you know, different mediums. So that's the thing I'm at right now. How do I make it feel fresh each time? Which I don't know that I've done that. And I look at, you know, people who do daily shows, daily things like that. And even like Weird Things, we recycle a lot of the same topics over and over again. There's always sort of a fun twist to it, but it still feels can be repetitious. So with the Periscope, that's one of the big struggles I'm wrestling with. And then, you know, you have to learn how do I just keep the conversation going when there are no questions? Because what I do now is I just launch right into, you know, I just start off like, here's the thing. I've first 7 or 8 minutes or whatever, I'm just talking about what I'm doing.
Yep.
And I often don't get questions because people are just listening. And then I got to go like, oh, if you guys have any questions, then the flow of questions starts and then I can't even keep up.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird.
It's very, very hard. And this is something that I, you know, opened by you in the chat mentioned in terms of like getting better at stuff. I wanted to get good at one mic stuff. And like my initial attempts at that are not good. Like, they are thudding. Like, I would consider that a failure now, right? But it's like, there's a necessity to getting good at what Andrew's getting good at right now, which is like understanding where pauses need to be, understanding where it's okay to take your breath, and understanding where, for Andrew's got even a higher degree of difficulty, because like he said, here's the worst thing you can do when nobody's talking. Ask for people to talk for you.
Yeah.
Right? And just say like, hey, what's your questions?
Awkward pause,
right? But if, like Andrew said, he goes through 20 minutes of here's the context and here's what we're doing and here's how you do it and this is what I've done. Here's an experience. Here's a story. Here's some stuff I've read on it. What do you guys think about that? Any further questions now that we've walked 20 minutes down this path? Bunch of questions. All of a sudden you've inflated the balloon and now people come at you. But that's something that you don't know until you do it, and there's still a refinement process, I'm sure.
One of the things I've learned and I picked up on was if you're gonna get the same question over and over again, is learn how to answer it different ways, because often people like ask you a question like, well, how should I answer this? Because like I answer it this way. I'm like, oh no, I just put it into a context of a thing I started talking about before. And that way people who've listened, because there are people who I would listen to ad nauseum who just anything they say, I'm like, not to say that I think anybody feels that about me, but I'm like, I do know that there are people that I would love to hear them give me 20 answers, 20 different approaches to the same question.
Well, and we see a bit of that. I think the One Mic Show is an interesting case study because you get someone like an Adam Carolla who it's like, if you've listened to him long enough, you heard him repeat stories a million times. And the reason for that is because while, yes, he's repeating the story a million times, there's no way you've listened to everything he's ever done. There's no way anyone could listen to everything he's ever done. And the odds are the majority of the people listening right now are hearing him for one of the very first times, and this is the first time for them to hear that story. Like, for example, nowadays when you listen to, for example, the Penn Sunday School podcast, there is such a confidence, and he's telling stories, and he's got referees where it's like he'll start to go into a story, and they know that he's said this story on the podcast before, and they'll let him know, and he'll give a much short and tightened version of it and keep on going. Whereas you listen to him when he first started on Real FM, Real Radio back in the day. Technically, all the structure was almost identical, but there was just a tightness to everything and those brief semantic crutches, and then the odd moment that he just suddenly reads a canned joke that he has in case he doesn't have anything to think of that's timely or whatever. And I don't know. I would imagine you've gone through a similar journey with The Jury and are continuing with the Periscopes.
Certainly so, you know, but JC Calhoun in the chat right now just says, you know, there's also the fact that sometimes people like hearing the same stories over and over again, that it's comforting, you know, to know, if you think a story is, or you think something is going to trigger a story and then it does, you're happy because in your brain you were like, oh yes, that's, I thought he was going to talk about that. He should. I hope maybe it'll change his conclusions because of this. Like, it's weird. It's a very complex matrix.
Well, like last night when I was setting up the Kevin Smith story with Cargill, I knew exactly how the story went, but I was really interested to hear it all again from a different perspective, right? Yeah. And I'm sure you watched part of it unfold. I'm sure there are people who knew more about it than, you know, even I did. And yet, that ended up being like a 40-minute epic saga telling all these different viewpoints that all collapsed to this one, you know, roundabout moment, in which case Kevin Smith's anger ends up creating Cargill.
Sure, yeah.
I remember when I worked with the amazing Randy, and Randy has great stories. Randy's one of the most amazing raconteurs you could ever imagine when it comes to these stories, because this is a guy that knew everybody, went everywhere. This is a guy who could hang out with, you know, Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and then Carl Sagan and Richard Feynman, and then go out into Hollywood and do this sort of stuff. So you can imagine the sort of scope of stories that he had. Of course, I would, you know, having known him since I was a teenager, you know, I would joke, he'd start a story like, "Did I ever tell you this?" I'd go, 42, you know, 13. And I'd kind of, you know, tease him with the fact that he'd start telling the stories, but I don't have stories. I mean, I have a handful of stories, but I don't have stories. And then when people ask me questions, I'll start to go through the same thing, and I start to have little bits of stories. But I appreciate that ability, what he had, and the ability to do that, and like what Kevin Smith has, and to be able to do that. But also the other side of it is, yeah, man, you know, I fear that fear of repetition of all of a sudden people are like,
you know what? Here's what I realized. Cause when I was 19 years old and I toured with CJ Johnson, he was in his late 30s, and it blew my mind that he kept making the same political observations, kept telling the same stories, kept complaining about the same things. And I would be like, yeah, you said this, you said all of this, you said, you know, what is it with old people who, you know, just keep repeating the same stuff? And now that I'm on the other side of that, I realize, no, what's important to them is to get the story right. They don't care. It's not important to keep a mental registry of everyone they've told the story to and who they've told it from.
Yeah, but I have this fear of becoming just sort of a loop. And I find myself very often just doing the same thing over and over. And I have like a 1 or 2 year period. I like this 1 year. Like, I remember when I moved into my house in South Florida, my townhouse, and that, you know, it was kind of my first year just being a creative on my own, creating magic tricks and stuff. I hadn't worked with Justin yet. A year went by that I cannot tell you what I did in that year. It's like a blackout period. And that scared the hell out of me because I'm like, I'm still a young guy. And this is, and I understand like part, like have kids because your life will be filled with a lot. There will definitely be moments when you're by yourself in a little townhouse like this. I can't remember a single thing from that year.
That was having a day job for me. That was that the fastest year of my entire life was once I got good at my job at Dell, and every day was the same. And every day was a lifetime. Every year was a minute. And I was just like, I don't want to blink and have it be all over. Right. So that was the nice thing about going on tour. Was every challenge was completely different, and there were elements that were the same, and then you had tools available, but it was like you were slaying a different monster every night.
That's when I made the decision, go for TV, go do what's the biggest, most crazy thing you could do. And I'm like, you know, kind of maybe I want to be on TV. Maybe that's the sort of thing I want to do. And it wasn't like it had been a desire when I was 13. It wasn't when I was older, but I'm like, pretend it's your passion.
Yeah.
Pretend it's your passion.
Although I will say this, you know, when I was working with Andrew, I mean, it was every day for lunch, get together with Andrew, go have lunch, go drive to whatever Arby's, Taco Bell, you know, whatever.
Nothing but the finest.
Nothing but the finest. Or wait, what was the Rolly, the roll restaurant that we went to a bunch initially? It was like all this, like, anyway, long story short. I'm sure that there were times, just days, where Andrew and I would just be these pre-programmed Furbies that would just tell each other the same story back and forth. That if everything was recorded, I would bet you that there were at least 2 days in which our back and forth was almost identical.
Isn't that the stereotype?
Roly poly. Yes, it was. Yeah. Roly poly. That was the story.
Isn't that the stereotype of two old friends, you know, like, you know, 80-year-olds telling the same stories over and over and over
Very
again?
Kind of you to not go married me. Couple, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, I mean, but that's like, you know, you just, there was a point in which, you know, you just keep, you run out of stories, keep telling the stories, and it was fine, you know?
Like,
it was.
Yeah, but the best times when we were doing new and different stuff, the best stories were working on her first pilot and getting so punch drunk we almost lost your eye.
Yes.
Or just, you know, that was sort of one of the things I said, you know what, I need to live a more interesting life and go do things and not just fall into this, become a Westworld robot on a loop.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, that's the best times were, yeah. No, what was it? No power tools after 4 a.m.
Oh, God. That was,
it was one time. All right. One story, since we're on the subject of stories, as part of Andrew's, one of the pilots that we shot, there was a thing that we were doing where without giving away the trick, I needed to ride a little mini motorcycle through as small of a hole as possible. And so we had to figure out how small the hole could be, how we had to build it into what we needed to build it into. And so we're in this industrial park in Broward County, Florida, and I'm on this little mini motorcycle, and we are punch drunk. Like, it is late, and we're on these, like, meh, 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 like these little.
We've got a deadline. We've got to got to load a whole trailer up with all of our gear to go to Orlando to go shoot a pilot for Rhymes with MTV.
Oh, my God.
And by the way, this is going to be in a crowded park.
Under pressure.
And this is like days away that we have to do this. And we got to figure out how to do it. And also how to stage manage everybody who is not us that is going to have to do the exact same thing, because there's people that aren't us. So we got to get it scientifically down. And so like, I'm the guinea pig because Andrew has to watch it and see how it looks and everything. And I go and like, pah, and I just hit the side. I hit the side.
No, well, first time you start to drive and you just, you're about 2 feet away from the hole and you just fall over on your side. he just goes, and then over, because he just lost his balance. His inner ear just went to sleep. It's like, I'm just going to fall over, take a nap. And we're giggling. We're cackling and laughing at how funny it was, because he's just like, right? We're like, all right. He's like, all right, I'll do this again. Then you get up to go through it.
And well, and then, you know, I just remember there was just a moment where I hit the frame, And
I had these two metal bars holding this thing up, these two pieces like angle L iron holding this square up, pointing straight at the direction you're coming from. Okay. Now, I could have pointed the other way. Did make sense. Did was perfectly fine the way it was. So they understand that's number one. Is I've set up this death trap of like these footlong black metal in the middle of the dark, pointing right at eye level.
I just remember Andrew's like, no judgment. Are you driving straight? And I just look up and I'm like, I think so. Like, it feels like I'm driving straight. And so he's like, all right, let me just, I'm not going to look at it at the angle that we're going to shoot at. I just want to see whether or not you're going to kill yourself. So he walks to the front to see how I'm driving. And he's like, no, you're definitely like veering fully to the left. Because like, I just kept trying to overcompensate by like getting like to overcompensate for my list that I didn't realize that I was doing.
Wow.
So he goes and he does it, and it's like he bap the thing, like hits him in the helmet or whatever, right? Hits him in the helmet, and taps him, and he falls back, and we're laughing, we're hysterics. And then I look at this piece of angle iron, I'm like, if that was an inch lower, you would have lost your eye.
Oh,
we're like,
because by the way, this is another element of it. The way the thing was, you had to get X amount of speed to go over it.
Right.
So you couldn't just like go slow. You had to like get going or else I would hit it.
It was
or
die.
Yeah, it would trap and I would fall like through the thing, but oh man. But that was hilarious. That was great.
We were in hysterics, and then we had this sort of like, oh man, no, that was almost really horrible. In the
that
trip
was
to the
almost
hospital.
A hospital trip.
Yeah.
But anyway. And then sometimes we would tell the same stories about, you know, our theories on who we would cast for a new Star Trek. You know,
Star Wars too.
Yeah. And Star Wars. Oh yeah. No. We booked all the territories. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Do we have picks?
Yeah, real quick. My pick is Voltron, because I'm going to sit down and watch it. It's a Netflix original. Second season is much better than the first, and I'm hoping to be able to watch another episode of it with my daughter tonight.
Andrew?
My pick is I'm gonna just keep going back and saying I'm always finding new ways to use my little notepad app on my iPhone, and I love my iPhone. I love this. I hope someday Apple develops a technology that would allow me to like directly transfer files from my iPhone back and forth to my Mac. I mean, I know they have a thing they call like, you know, that's supposed to do that, but it don't work reliably. But I do find that if I need to drop AirDrop does not work for me consistently. Mm. So if I need to do it, I just drop an image into my Notes app and it appears everywhere, because Notes has gotten really, really good. I outlined an entire book Monday in Notes sitting in my bed on my iPad, like, you know, like 30 chapters of outline just for like, I don't remember having to type it. It just flowed. So
yeah, wow, that's great.
Yeah,
Notes app. My pick is a super high tech way that I have become more productive, especially when it comes to visualizing the weeks ahead. Because I've always been trapped in the week. Like I've always just thought about Monday through Friday. That's the farthest that my brain would stretch, right? And it's often got me into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Dry erase calendar.
It's the best thing ever.
It's a 1 month dry erase calendar. It forces me at the beginning of every month to write it out and write out the days and see how many like Mondays I have. Yada yada yada. Like it allows me to add things. I got into the habit lately of writing like the big goal for the day, like my own little like statement of purpose and mantra for the day, and freed made me think more about that, like that on Saturday and Sunday it's relax, like it's just take the time to do exactly what you want and enjoy the fruits of your labor. But on, you know, days like this week, it's made me think more about stuff. Like the reason why we're doing this now on Wednesday is because I'm not going to be around Sunday, right? And so we have all probably could stand to be better about communicating, you know, like conflicts and stuff like that. The dry erase board made me say I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. I need to bank episodes to certain shows when I know that it's not going to be reliable for me to be able to do stuff on certain days. I'd rather just have a banked episode for a lot of the stuff that I'm doing. If there's a conflict that I can switch around, let's send that email a week ahead of time as opposed to 48 hours ahead of time. It's done wonders for me in a way that Google Calendar never really could for me, just because, and I'm sure, listen, if there was a big, awesome digital display where I could do everything that I could do on a thing.
One that was persistent 24 hours in the periphery of your vision, something that would intrude on your eyesight line.
Then maybe I could do the same thing, right? Yeah. And maybe it would be even better. But for right now, Dry Erase Calendar has done wonders for me being more proficient, because at the point where I'm doing as many podcasts as I'm doing now, and I have to work with as many different people as I do, it just, there's like, I can't afford to be negligent about that kind of pre-planning. And it's been a wonder. So there we go. Dry Erase, big wall calendar.
Bri, you were alluding to something.
I don't know. Was I with
a calendar? Do you have like some magical?
Dry. No. I when I heard dry erase, I went nuts because dry erase board is a way to I'm a big fan of writing your goals and posting them in the shower because it intrudes on a time that you normally would not be thinking about this problem or whatever, and it guides you in that direction. It reminds you this is a pressing thing. This is what you told yourself you do. Dry erase boards do that for short term, you know, projects and everything. Bonnie is the same way. She can't. She never took to any electronic calendar of any type at all.
Yeah.
And when it's worked the best for me, it's been a live and die by the calendar thing. Yeah. Electronically.
I use this thing, that wall calendar. Last year it was a dry erase. I thought I was buying a dry erase, but it wasn't. This is actually, you know, an actual write-on, but same difference.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I use a full year. The reason I use a full year is because, like, if I have something booked way out, I want to be able to see that it's coming. And I remember, like, I learned that actually Randy was working with Randy, because Randy had his yearly calendar, and Randy would be on the phone like, hey, we want to see about booking him for such and such, and watch Randy get up and, well, let me look at the calendar. He physically have a calendar to go look at. And I can see, like, at some point, if I had a big, huge digital display, it may be cool. But I live and die by that thing. So,
yeah, I would very much like for, you know, monitors and touchscreen technology to get to the point where I could have a fully, transferable, and I could go easily from, you know, 30 days to 5 days or to 1 day. But until that happens, until those single use touchscreen, flat screen monitors are flooding the market, I feel like the dry erase bird is it's fine. It's good. It makes me be active in my own planning, which is important.
Just a closing thought, too, is that January is almost up.
Yeah.
2017, man. I was saying this before, like, that's a thing, is like, before you know it, it's the middle of the year.
Yeah. Though, and again, for anyone who's like, oh, man, but that's a lot of work, write down your goal, write down the deadline, and yes, it will be a lot of work, but here's the good news. The time is going to pass anyway, period.
Yep. And you're true fact. Done it. We're all in a very slow time machine, no matter what.
it is. No, that's right.
Gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.